Welcome to Community Stories on WFHR. I'm your host, Melissa Kay. This week in our veteran series, you're going to meet the new principal at Lincoln High School, Rod Watson. He's also a captain in the 105th Cavalry Regiment in the National Guard. He's in military intelligence as part of the 32nd Infantry Brigade. Captain Watson shares about his time in Iraq as a military truck driver, among other duties, during the early 2000s. We'll learn about his journey and adventures he had overseas, where he found that our shared humanity is much more powerful than our differences, even if we don't speak the same language. Later in the show, you'll hear a familiar voice you know from these airwaves when I get to sit down with our very own Tom Heiser. But I'll save that introduction for later. First, here's LHS Principal and Captain in the National Guard, Rod Watson. Welcome to Community Stories. I have with me today a Rod Watson, who is a member of the National Guard. Rod, would you please introduce yourself and tell me your position in the National Guard?
Sure. My name is Rod Watson. I'm the principal at Lincoln High School. But in the military world, I'm Captain Watson for the 105th National Guard, or 105th Cavalry Regiment in the National Guard. So my job there is military intelligence. My job is to tell the boss what the bad guys are going to do tomorrow so we can get ready today. Part of the 32nd Infantry Brigade in drill in Madison right now.
Okay. What prompted you to get involved in the military?
I first joined in 99. I wanted to pay for college, and I was jealous of a cousin who went in the Navy and came out bigger than me. So I thought paying for college, you know, if you come from like a lower middle class family and you really want to go to college, it's out of reach. You're going to be paying debt the rest of your life. And so I thought service in the military would meet with my goals of duty. But I also thought the college loan repayment and the money you get for veterans grant and things would be very helpful. So I joined the Army Reserves in Illinois as a truck driver. I served 6 years as an enlisted soldier, including a year plus tour in Iraq. And then when I got done with that contract, I let it expire and had a 9-year break in service. And then I just missed being part of the military culture. So I re-enlisted at this time to commission here in Wisconsin in 2015. The goal there was to become an officer, and then I picked the branch of military intelligence. So just basically, the military provides a lot of opportunities for you. You get a lot of benefits, and also you get to have an interesting life. You do all kinds of things that are beyond the pale of like the ordinary. And I think that makes life more interesting and rich and challenging. And then, you know, the benefits are substantial, but then the sense of duty and the fact that you're giving back to the country that gives you so much is really fulfilling.
And so let's jump back a little bit. You were a truck driver when you first joined up. Can you tell me anything about your time in Iraq?
Yeah, I went to Iraq in March 2003. And so we were right behind the initial push. But as a truck driver, I'm not part of the infantry and the Marines that broke the Iraqi army. We're the ones that came right after that when things were still smoking. And then we occupied that country. And as a truck driver, my main job was to move our water purification units around and any supplies. And so remembering those skills, because I'm a history teacher by trade at this point. So I just drove trucks in training and on the weekends, and not very well. And so learning how to do that in Iraq, where there's no traffic laws and lots of rabid dogs and people don't pay attention to traffic at all, and you don't want to run them over, you're getting shot at, everything's different. Ooh. And the trucks at that point were old. So if you think of think of footage of like the early part of the Iraq war, you're looking at like deuce and a half and 5-ton trucks that are surviving from the Vietnam War. They don't have a ton of horsepower. They're all stick shift and fun to drive. None of them are up armored, so snipers are very effective against them. And so we didn't have a lot of that yet, but we're vulnerable and not very well trained. We had no communication in the vehicles. There's no radios. There's no, like now if you get in a military vehicle, you have multiple forms of communication. You have computer programs and radios. Then you get nothing except your horn. If you remember the original stories, from 2003, people got lost a lot and people get ambushed a lot. And that's why we just didn't have that training. We convoyed from Kuwait into Iraq in March 2003 and then occupied a base northwest of Tikrit, where Saddam Hussein's hometown was. And that base was called FOB Spiker, named after a soldier who had been prisoner of war there.
Oh, wow.
And so I basically stayed there for a year, running a water point and moving supplies. I also went to Kirkuk and helped with the water point there for a while and just did a lot of missions back and forth from Kuwait, or a moderate amount, to resupply the area. And then in late April of 2004, we came home.
Hmm. So do you feel like over that time there that you got better at the truck driving?
I think moderately so. It was strangely a smaller part of my job than I thought. It ended up being more part of the water purification part of it and then just basic soldering.
Well, water is important.
It is, but maybe less than you think because we didn't drink it.
Oh.
And so we had, I mean, this is a time, if you think back to the early 2000s and late 90s, this is when water bottles took over the world.
Oh.
Right. And so if you were in the early 90s, you'd never seen water in a bottle in your life. Right. And then by the late 90s, they're everywhere. And these plastic bottles are a menace. Right. Mm-hmm. So in 2003, when we went into Iraq, we went with the purpose of providing drinking water. We ended up providing bathing water.
Oh.
And so because the suppliers brought in all these bottles of water, and Iraq didn't have garbage. They had human and animal waste, but they didn't have a culture where you have things wrapped in lots of layers of plastic. And so they had no garbage services. They had no landfills. But then we come in with our MREs. You know what those are?
Right.
All right. And so then, and then water bottles, and then they had soda producers there too. They like soda in Iraq. And so suddenly we started getting lots of garbage. But yeah, the water, when we purify it through the military, it ends up tasting quite chlorinated. So you don't usually want to drink that. It doesn't taste that great.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't as chlorinated as like pool water, but enough that it'll make you plenty regular. And so the... Yeah, we didn't want to drink that much. Ends up being the shower and the cleaning water.
But it's still important to have purified water for showers and bathing.
It is. Yeah, and that's why we kept a job. I think Caleb brought in Ruth, the civilian contractors, took over a lot of the work when we left. But the aquifer in Iraq is pretty far down, so we had to find wells that would get down below the ground level. And then we'd find that there's lots of E. coli in the water from animal waste and things. So learning how to purify that and teaching Iraqis how to do that, because their rivers are trickles compared to what they were when this was the center of the world.
Because it's basically desert everywhere.
Yeah, so a lot of it's been dammed up in Turkey, and so like the Tigris and Euphrates don't have the power they used to, and the Fertile Crescent's gone, and so now it's just a desert, and you're not farming your way out of that.
Right. Now let's jump back a little bit. You mentioned MREs. For our listeners who don't know what an MRE is,
you should eat an MRE at least once in your life so you know what soldiers are up against. It's high calorie meal that, you know, one or two of them will get you through a day. There's lots of food packaged in there. There is a little heater if you want for the main course, which could be like chili or beans, or there's a little pizza. Don't eat that one. there's a spinach one. So you get lots of little pieces of food packaged in lots of cellophane and plastic. And then there's other amenities in there like toilet paper and Tabasco sauce, and there's a spoon. And then they just become currency. So once you open them up, then you're like, I like the spinach and you like the Skittles, and so we'll trade, or maybe there's a guard duty shift on the line. And so, but MREs, until you get a chow hall set up and actual supply lines, you're eating those all the time, and they get old real fast.
Did you eat any of the cultural food there while you were there?
Unfortunately. So there was a week where I helped, and my unit helped some Iraqis rebuild their field through the invasion and through Saddam's regime. It had been destroyed pretty badly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we helped them to fix their irrigation. And what they can do with irrigation in Iraq is just unbelievable. They can move one little pile of dirt and suddenly the water's going a completely different way. But their pumps weren't working. And so we worked for a week helping these farmers. And to reward us, to thank us, they killed their only chickens and served them to us.
Oh.
Well, we didn't really want to eat them. They weren't very healthy-looking chickens, but we did. And then all of us spent the next day in the porta-potties regretting our choices.
Oh, no.
So their stomachs are stronger than ours, and they're more used to bacteria than we are.
Mm.
We shouldn't eat their food because of that, and then a lot of our food has pork, and Muslims don't want to eat that. And so we couldn't trade often the food.
Gotcha. So since you have returned after your active duty service there, tell me about life after that.
Well, I came back and it felt like everything was pretty easy after that. If you can get through a year of living in that, it's weird that you can fly from this world to that one, by the way, that you can go from a world where like our biggest concerns are what we're going to have for dinner tonight, or, you know, we have concerns, but they don't feel legitimate when you go to a country like Iraq where like you don't know if you're going to make it till tomorrow. And it is an awful place to live. It is so hot. I come back and everything feels pretty easy. I get a teaching job right away in the Chicago suburbs. And then within 2 years, I let my military contract expire because I never intended for it to be a career. I was using it as a stepping stone.
Right.
And then I just, Was a teacher, got my advanced degrees, ended up getting a master's and a doctorate through the Veterans Grant in Illinois. And then my wife convinced me to move to Wisconsin, where she's from, to get an admin job in Shawano, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And in Shawano, I missed the military life. I met a couple of recruiters that came in, and they kind of reminded me, like, people in their late 30s have pretty good military lives, too. And so that's when I reenlisted in the Wisconsin National Guard. And the National Guard is a far more professional organization than the Reserves. Like, reserve duty on the weekends when you're training, at least in my unit, we didn't do anything. Probably were supposed to. We didn't do anything. In the National Guard, they use every minute of your time. And so, like, you are training and training and training so that you know what you're doing when it matters. And it's part of this because you have the state mission and the federal mission, because you do, like, disasters and civil disturbances and things. Like, I've deployed to protect the Capitol after the insurrection of January 6th. I've deployed to help with the COVID missions. I've done lots of small duties here and there that have helped me to be a stronger part of the community, where I didn't have to do that stuff in the reserves.
I see.
So I commissioned as an officer in 2017 and went through the ranks. I'm up to captain now. And I got, we just finished the JRTC cycle in Louisiana. That's Joint Force Readiness Training Center. It's the most challenging training anybody could do.
Did you enjoy it?
No. No, if anybody says they enjoyed it, they're lying to you. So we sent 5,000 soldiers to Louisiana to train against Geronimo. These are people that are trained to fight us. We use electronic gear to see, like, to simulate warfare, and they beat us pretty badly. And so it was, that's a battalion, we're a brigade, we shouldn't lose, but they knew we were coming, they knew what we were going to do, and we weren't yet good at our jobs. That's why you do this training. But it was about 15 days of misery. And it was just miserable enough that you start to empathize with soldiers that have done actual misery. Like the 32nd Brigade, for instance, in World War II, served for almost 500 days of consecutive active duty in Papua New Guinea. And so if you could think about how miserable it was to serve for 15 days when the enemy is not actually trying to kill you, you're just uncomfortable and stressed. And then you think about what World War II soldiers did, what Vietnam soldiers did, and let's not forget Korea. You know, then that's, you get that perspective, realize, like, the hardening you need to get through real times of adversity, you only get a taste of that in a training environment. And it's not fun to taste it, but it's necessary.
Yeah, it gives you a different perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also reminds you, like, training on the weekend is not going to get you job proficiency. You have to train against an agile and intelligent enemy who can anticipate what you're going to do. And you have to train in an austere environment where you can't have your phone to rely on, and you can't allow yourself to get distracted and have runs of the PX to get yourself your Monster energy drinks. Like, you have to be in a situation where, like, everyone is working together to try to survive.
Right.
And in this environment, we have actual tanks and actual helicopters and artillery rounds and things that are pretty dramatic going on, then it simulates as close as you can without real bullets flying.
Stick around. We'll be right back with a continuation of the story.
And we're back with Community Stories. I'm Melissa Kay, and I've been talking with Rod Watson, a captain in the National Guard and current principal at Lincoln High School in Wisconsin Rapids. Listen in as Captain Watson continues to share his story and talks about the importance of community in the military here on Community Stories.
So you mentioned that the reason that you re-enlisted is because you missed the military camaraderie atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that a little bit. What did you miss about it?
The fellowship you get with other soldiers is far more powerful than, like, your loyalty to your country. That's all great, but it's abstract, right? And so, like, you don't get up in the morning and say, gee, I want to serve my country today. It's just a nice thing to do. You really think about, like, I don't want to let the other guys down. And when you're, especially as you rise in the ranks of leadership in the civilian world, it can get kind of lonely being in charge because you don't have peers as much anymore. Like, I'm a principal. There's, like, you know, there's a few of us in the district. But there's, when you get to the point where, like, you're not hanging out with your subordinates anymore, you don't have a lot of camaraderie anymore. And the military absolutely has that. They take care of each other. They give each other a really hard time. But it's all in the name of, like, being part of a team. And it's easy to miss that as you get older. I also felt like as an enlisted soldier, I did maximize my service. You know, now I have a doctorate degree, I have a decent amount of education, and extreme interest in history and in the military. So I'm like, I can do better than being a truck driver. There's nothing wrong with being a truck driver, but, like, that's not where your career culminates.
Right.
And so I thought I should earn all these accolades I get during Veterans Day when everybody's shaking my hands. And I remember coming back from Iraq, and a little girl walked up to me in the airport, and her mom was behind her, and a girl says, reached out her little hand, and she goes, I wanted to meet a hero.
Aww.
and I'm looking around for who she's trying to talk to. Like, I certainly wasn't heroic, right? But that's not the welcome that the Vietnam veterans got.
No.
And the way our country now treats veterans makes it much easier to want to serve as a career instead of as a something to endure.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me anything about the current job you have in intelligence?
Yeah, so there is a lot of classified information in regards to intelligence, but the way classification works is that if you have a need to know something, then you're allowed to know it, even if you have top secret clearance. So, like, I don't have a need to know most of our military secrets, so therefore I don't. But my current job is to analyze the enemy threat as best as possible and make sure that our current bosses can respond accordingly. So if you make a plan, the enemy is doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so and it's not just the enemy. You worry about, you worry about the terrain and the weather and other things that affect your plan. And so my job is to put that intelligence into our plans to say, I know you want to attack this way, sir, but the enemy knows you're coming and they've already set up these obstacles and they already have lines of fire here. Mm-hmm. Or, and usually, you know, that through collection, like we're using satellites or something to look at where the enemy's at, or through intuition, mm-hmm. Or through analysis of any enemy doctrine and tactics. And then also, like, what they've done in the past. And so the current threat, as I'm sure your listeners know and you know, is Russia. And right? Mm-hmm. So China is determined to be the most existential threat, but the current threat of who's actually on the battlefield and fighting our weapon systems is Russia. And so learning Russian tactics, which are significantly different than ours, and making sure that our bosses are making battle plans that respond to that, helps us be ready for the next fight.
See. And so you said also weather.
Yeah.
So are you... Have you studied weather patterns? And
no, that's not the job. Is not weather man as much as weather analysis. And so you have to figure out, like, if you're fighting in a hot and humid condition, what's that do to your comm systems, communications? Uh-huh. What's that do to your artillery systems? If the enemy has chemical capabilities and it's really windy, does that diminish their impact? So you figure the impact of them, because every soldier, at least in an environment where they have their phones, could give you the same weather report. It's 82 degrees. Congratulations, but. The sun's going to set at 8:35. That's important. It's actually going to get dark at 8:52. That's important. And then why is that important? Well, this is the enemy tends to attack once it gets actually dark. They have better night vision capabilities than we do, or whatever kind of analysis you can actually provide.
Gotcha.
That's what adds value to the boss, because he can look out the weather.
I see.
Yeah.
So what would you say, or what do you say, to young people about joining the military?
They have to make sure it's right for them. And it's not as simple as people think. I know that sometimes I cringe when a student says, I want to join the military. I'm like, but you don't ever do what you're told. And that's all you would do in the Army, is what you're told. However, sometimes people don't do what they're told because they actually have an instinct towards leadership. Uh-huh. Right? And so, like, think about any leader in history who is famous for doing what they're told. Right. And so that's not really how leaders are built. But you do have to learn the time and place to buck authority.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic training is not that time. Right.
No. So you got to get through that step first.
Yes. It would just be a miserable experience to go to basic training and say, I'm not going to do what the drill sergeant say. I'm like, you're going to get very strong in the next 9 weeks. So I tell young people, like, make sure you actually want to do this. Like, this is a commitment. You're not getting out of it. And so sometimes people do try. And you have to make sure you love this country enough to serve it and do really dangerous things in its name.
Mm-hmm.
I often encourage too, like, are you going to get transferable skills from this? Like, if you really want to join and you want to be infantry, that's great. We need infantrymen. You have to figure out how to market those skills. Because in a job interview, explaining that you have learned to be very proficient at closing with and destroying the enemy doesn't usually get you a job. It gets you raised eyebrows. We don't like that kind of behavior in civilian society.
Right.
But learning how to express that I learned how to solve problems, work as a team, accomplish objectives. These are the real things that infantrymen do. And then doing that in the civilian world in any capacity makes you value added to that organization. So helping young people know that the military is not just a place to go have adventures. You're going to build these skills. And you could also just pick a job that's not infantry. Like, you'd be a fireman. Come back and be a fireman. And you got trained. You got paid to train instead of the other way around.
Right.
And then just, you've got to have the physical fitness. Like, that's the part we forget sometimes. But our country's not as fit as it could be.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a diminishing percentage of people who can join just based on their basic level of fitness.
Even though they've lowered those somewhat over the years.
Yeah, they have. So we do an ACFT now. So the APFT, so the Army Combat Fitness Test, involves 6 events. We used to have just the 3. Mm-hmm. The 3 were push-ups, sit-ups, and 2-mile run. The unspoken secret is that the new 6-event test is usually passed. Almost everybody passes it. But it is challenging to do all six things. You will be gassed when you try.
Need to be in shape.
You do. So, and then it's often followed up by a tape test to see if you are the right body composition.
Mm-hmm.
Because soldiers are supposed to be fit and slim as much as possible. So the fitness test involves deadlift with a hex bar, maximum rep, maximum weight, and then a medicine ball throw over your head, 10-pound medicine ball, 10-pound as far as you can throw it. And then a push-pull-drag-carry, which simulates like refilling ammo positions and dragging wounded people off a battlefield. And then a hand-release push-up, which is similar to the old push-ups, but you take your hand off the ground repeatedly. And then it was a leg tuck, but now they're doing a plank instead. And then it finishes up with a 2-mile run. And so you do those six events consecutively, you will be done for the day.
And
so,
and maybe a few days afterward.
Yeah, and even if it's harder to fail military fitness standards than it used to be, which I think is true, because the standards are lower than they were, you are still going to work your butt off. And you better be in shape to do that, or it's just miserable. Like what I just did in Louisiana for 2 weeks, if I wasn't in decent shape, like it just wears you out because we weren't even the most active section. I was in a tactical operations center, so we basically stayed in the same place, but you're still setting up lots of things, moving all the time, no sleep, high humidity, lots of gear. And I think, I don't know if your listening public can relate to what you see on TV and you think about what soldiers have to carry now. We are so heavy.
Mm.
You know, on top of your uniform, you have your vest, which has all of your gear on it, your medical equipment, your ammo. And the training environment, you have like electronic equipment on it too. And then on top of that, you have to carry water. You have to carry lots of water with you. And then you have a weapon. And then you have usually some kind of body armor. It's underneath that or with that. And then you have your helmet.
Wow.
All right, and so you carry all that stuff. And now if I'm not carrying a bag as well, which would have my food and sleeping system and rain gear and stuff in it, then even if I don't, I'm heavy, right? And so,
right.
Like, it just diminishes your motivation to do anything and your agility, which the enemy does not have that problem.
Mm.
And then if you're not in shape on top of that, then you're not going to be able to get that done.
So, and you're not going to be able to support your comrades.
No, they'll be dragging you around.
Right.
So your question was, like, what do you talk to young people about with that stuff? Like, do you love your country enough to, like, overcome the adversity and do this? Do you love adventure? Can you handle doing what you're told enough to get through basic training, you know, because the Army isn't looking for just yes men and women, but they are looking for people who can be compliant and disciplined enough to do things they don't feel like doing. Because in battle, we don't want people saying why when it's time to do things.
Well, yeah.
And then on top of all that, are you willing to be brave enough to do really dangerous stuff? And are you willing to get in shape in the way that we need you to.
Mm-hmm. So, to be able to physically do what is asked of you.
Yeah. And I mean, I think people are aware that our recruiting numbers aren't great right now. Mm-hmm. Like, it's hard to get young people to join the military. You'd have to ask them why that is, but it could be a strong economy. It could be that, you know, maybe the wages haven't risen as fast as inflation. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not getting high recruitment numbers right now. And that means that we're missing out on a younger generation of people that should be doing this training so they can be the senior soldiers later.
Right.
I won't be in forever, and neither will my peers.
Mm-hmm.
And we need the up-and-comers, and there just aren't that many young people.
So there's a gap.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And to do this training in Louisiana, we had to bring lots of soldiers in from different states to plus us up enough to get back to 100%.
To get enough numbers.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that the military culture has changed from where it was when you joined in the 90s?
Yeah. Most of the changes took place before I joined. The idea of like actually physically harming soldiers who weren't doing what they're told had gone away. You used to be able to like punch people.
Corporal
and things.
Discipline.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore. And so I'll say that they could be quite insulting when I joined. The trainers could be as a way of like getting compliance, and you don't see that anymore. They're far more respectful.
Mm.
When I first joined, if soldiers were not heterosexual, they could not tell people that. You could get kicked out if you ever mentioned your sexuality, if it was different than heterosexuality. Now, nobody cares. Like, it's all the same. So we go through training to make sure that people are respectful of each other, no matter their race, creed, sexuality, whatever, because all that really matters is, can you do this job?
Right.
And usually soldiers roll their eyes at this kind of training. It's like, obviously, right? Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you will find sometimes soldiers will join the military and be racist for about 3 minutes. Because you'll find out quickly that black drill sergeant, his skin color is not the thing you need to be afraid of. And so the things that make us, that divide us as a society, are often due to unfamiliarity. And once you spend time with someone, you realize, I don't care what her gender association is or her sexual orientation or whatever, like, she's doing the job.
And, right. You know, and I can rely on her in an emergency situation.
Right? Yeah. And so you don't hear, I think when I started, you'd hear more racism, bigotry kind of jokes, at least. Now you don't hear that stuff as much. And probably far less than in society. And the military has always been on the cutting edge of this stuff, right? We desegregated the military before we desegregated our country. We've done, you know, we let women serve sooner than they served in most professional businesses here in the country, not as soon as we should have. But now we have a fully integrated military. Women can do almost every job that men can do. And it's made us much stronger as a fighting force than our opponents who haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah.
And so that's a culture I've seen. I will say that, like, the cell phone culture has taken over, and so getting soldiers to focus enough to get the job done and put their phones away has not been easy. When I first joined, most soldiers smoked cigarettes, then that went away for a while, and now they're all vaping. And so, you know, like, we're back to dependency on things that are not good for your lungs. Mm-hmm. And so that's been different.
And you need those lungs when you got to be physically active.
And we all need lungs, yeah. And so, like, that's, I wish people could understand that the vaping industry is not looking out for best interests, and it's only getting worse. Mm-hmm. So there's a few changes like that. I think that also the change to overall job competency instead of just like routine training. The military is a very serious organization that builds very good leaders, and they're very serious about making sure that our training events lead to proficiency in the job skills that we need. We don't always meet that mark, but we certainly try, and it's just less routine. Like, today we're going to do rifle marksmanship. No, today we're going to practice, you know, movement to contact or something that is a lot more complicated. And so that might be also my perspective going from the reserves to the National Guard. Okay. But it really seems like more professional training is the norm now than it was.
Well, that's a good thing, because we definitely need that.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you would want to share with our listeners?
I think people often, well, okay, I'll start with this story. When I worked at Shawano Middle School, I would get interviewed by sixth graders every year about my experience in Iraq.
Oh, okay.
And the very good teacher there would have the students write down their question on note cards so they wouldn't forget it. And then I could answer the questions from the front of the room, and I came in uniform. And I was associate principal there, but they didn't see me in uniform. So,
right.
And their questions were awesome. And so it might entertain your readers to hear, like, some of the best questions I can remember. Well, okay, first of all, a large majority of them were about food. Sixth graders are just hungry from the time they wake up to the time they go to bed. So, all, like, what did you eat? And then I remember one said, did you have a gun, and what was his name? Like, well, Molly, but thanks for asking. And then another one was, did you die?
Oh.
Like, well, you know, I don't think so, but I guess it's possible. I work at Lincoln now. I worked at Pittsville last year. Those of us that work with young people, provide opportunities for them to speak to soldiers when they can, to understand that, like, and not just soldiers, like the people who are serving on the front lines in our society are really police officers, right? And like, I dealt with dangerous things for a year. They do it every single day.
Yeah.
And so finding time to hear their story and learn like how they get up every day and keep us safe. Mm-hmm. I feel like I get a lot more accolades as a part-time soldier than police officers do doing this every day. I talked to one police officer recently who said he's pulled over 100 bodies out of cars in his career.
Oh my.
And he goes to bed every night with that. Right. And so if there's anybody listening that can think about, like, how are we exposing our young people to veterans and firemen and police officers who can share their story of service, so we can try to instill that sense in our young people, that's how we sustain the society. The other thing that I've learned the most in my career is that most of us in this world are the same. And we do like to figure out what divides us. We spend a lot of time worried about that, I think. Is our skin color different? Is our orientation different? You know, genders are different, whatever. There are differences, I get it.
Right.
But I work shoulder to shoulder with Iraqis who were raised in a different culture, you know, different religion than me. And they're just human beings. Mm-hmm. They just wanted to, like, be left alone, have the best life they can for their family. And, you know, at the end of the day, when you're sharing some cold sugar beverages with each other, and you're just trying to communicate with, like, seven shared words between two languages, you realize that, like, our shared humanity is much more powerful than our differences.
Mm-hmm. You know, even if they have more iron stomachs than you do.
Yeah, right. That difference was important that day. But our similarities, I think we really get focused on our differences when we try to train each other and how to be respectful. But I think we got to come back to the idea that we are mostly the same. Our differences are interesting, and that makes us all unique and fun to be around and exciting. But our similarities also bring us together, and we forget that part sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sitting down with me today, Rod. It was a pleasure to meet you.
You're welcome. Hope we get to talk to you again.
Yes. And thank you for sharing your story with our community.
You're welcome.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more stories from your community. And now, back to community stories.
This man needs no introduction, but as your host, I'm Melissa Kay, will do it anyway. Tom Heiser is a well-known voice here on WFHR, and now you get to hear his story. It's a good one, too. Tom is very involved with our local veterans organizations, including the VVA, the VFW, County Veterans Service Commission, and more. You hear him regularly during our monthly veterans update at the beginning of each month. Now let's jump back to the 60s, when young men were drafted into the Army. Tom shares his story of how that unfolded for him.
My name is Tom Heiser, H-E-I-S-E-R, and I live in Wisconsin Rapids.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for sitting down with me today. Tell me about the military organizations that you're currently involved in.
I'm the secretary for the Vietnam Veterans of America, Chapter 101. I'm the adjutant, which is also the secretary for the VFW, Post 2534.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the chairman of the County Veterans Service Commission, which meets a couple times a year, which could meet even more if need be. I'm on the Selective Service Board for Central Wisconsin. If they'd ever go back to the draft, I'd be involved in that.
Hmm.
And my wife and I did reunions of my unit from Vietnam for several years until health issues came arose.
Oh, that's a lot of organizations, Tom.
It does keep me busy.
Keep you out of trouble?
It does keep me busy.
All right. Well, let's jump back and tell me what prompted you to join the military in the first place.
In the mid to late 60s, the government instituted the draft program, where they took 366 tennis or ping pong balls, put them in a container, and then drew them out. So, like, they drew January 1st, it could be number 80. January 2nd could be number 345. So your birthday was associated with a number.
Okay.
And I lived in Fond du Lac County at the time, and the stories going around were if you were under, your number was under 200, you were going to get drafted. And that was a true story, not just a rumor. And my number was under 200.
Mm.
So I decided, well, I would rather choose what I wanted to do rather than the government say, you will do this.
Mm.
So,
because that's how the draft worked? For those of us who don't know, they picked you where you...
Right, they just picked you and...
picked your branch and picked your...
Now you're in the Army or now you're in the Marine Corps and here's what you're going to be.
Wow. So instead of that, you wanted to choose.
Right. So my decision was, I wanted to go into the military police.
Okay.
And their requirement was you had to be 5'8".
And how old are you at this time?
I'm 19.
Okay.
So you had to be 5'8", and I was 5'10". So I knew, okay, there's not going to be an issue here. And the recruiter said, no issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I signed up. Well, you got down to Milwaukee, and you had to go through the physical. And their measuring unit wasn't, not standardized.
Okay.
It was a little bit off. So they measured me at 5'7.5".
Wow, that's a pretty big
difference.
Discrepancy there.
Right. And I said, well, I'm 5'10". And the person running the machine said, this is a piece of government equipment. It is right and you are wrong.
Because, yes, our government is infallible.
Right. So I went and found a sergeant. I said, how tall are you? And he said, 6'2". I said, would you get measured? Sure. He came down and measured him at 6 foot, so it was 2 inches off. And I remember the sergeant looking at this guy and saying, this machine is wrong. With all due respect, Sergeant, this is a piece of government equipment. It is right and you are wrong.
Oh, my goodness.
So after about 4 measurements, I got to be at 5'7.75", which I was still too short. So I just asked them, I said, now what happens? They said, well, you signed up. We can choose what you are going to be because you enlisted. And the person on there said, well, we're looking at your test scores, and there is this he called it the Army within the Army. It was a military intelligence organization. I said, well, what do they do? He said, we don't know. It's all top secret. You have to get a top secret clearance. But you do qualify. And I said, okay. He said, oh, by the way, the Army Security Agency, which the name of the organization was, does not go to Vietnam.
Yeah, you're wearing a Vietnam veteran hat there, Tom.
Yeah, we'll get into that. But it's all secret. We don't know. They don't go to Vietnam. And it takes a lot of training.
Okay.
So I said, okay, I'll sign up for that. You know, you're 19 years old, and they're putting all these carrots in front of you, and you're just going, yeah, 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 that's cool. And signed up for it and went to my basic training, which was in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And that was 6 weeks. And then my advanced training was in Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And that was 14 weeks because we had to learn Morse code. I was a Morse code intercept operator.
Oh.
And got talking to him, and I says, well, ASA doesn't go to Vietnam, does it? And he said, no, the ASA does not go to Vietnam. Radio research goes to Vietnam. So they changed our
titles
from Army Security Agency, which we were in Europe and America and Africa and everywhere else, but in Vietnam and Thailand, you were radio research. So got sent to Germany, was doing my job over there, and all these guys were coming back from Vietnam, were getting stationed in Germany, and they're telling me about it, talking about it, and they said, well, you know, I'm doing my job here, and it's getting kind of boring. It's the same thing. So I signed up and got shipped to Vietnam for 11 months and Thailand for one. So it was interesting.
I imagine.
I say Morse code intercept operator, and we can talk a little bit about what we did, but not a lot because some of it's still classified.
Okay, I have one burning question. Can you still communicate with Morse code?
A little bit. I do have a ham radio license.
Wow.
I'm not real active in it, but it's been a while, and the letters are still in there.
That's incredible, because that's a long time ago.
Right.
Wow.
Wow. About 14 weeks of it being drilled into you, so it's something that's still there.
Well, and then you used it for almost a year, or...
3 years.
3 years. Okay. I thought you said 11 months and then 1 month.
Well, I was in Germany.
Oh, okay.
And then I came back, and we got out of the military. We were stationed in Virginia at the time.
Okay. So let's jump back to when you were overseas, because this is just... For me, I love different cultures and different foods. For anybody that listens to The Kitchen's Open will know that. What was the food like while you were there?
Very, very, very spicy.
Do you like spice?
No.
Okay.
Body parts do not like spice.
So it was a little traumatic for you.
Yes, and health standards are a lot different in Vietnam than they are here. So you go through the markets and there would be fish, different seafood items, and flies.
And flies. Oh my.
So it's it. And,
right.
You know,
because they're outside markets, right?
Right. They were outside markets. And some of the foods you had was like fish head soup.
Okay.
I just don't get real excited about something looking at me that I'm eating.
That's fair, Tom. That's fair.
No, it was very spicy. Did try it sometimes, but not a lot.
Yeah. So did you have Army rations?
Because where we were, we weren't out in the field as such. We were back in the base.
Okay.
Because of what we did, they didn't want us getting captured or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is the first person killed in Vietnam was a military intelligence guy by the name of, last name of Davis. And whenever you land in Saigon, you go through Davis Station. It was named after the first guy killed, and it was a military intelligence guy.
Wow. Did you serve with him?
No, he was the first guy killed in Vietnam. I was there towards the end.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. This is showing my poor understanding of war history.
No problem. But yeah, he was there in like mid-60s.
Okay. And you were there during the...
71, 72, towards the end.
72, okay. So can you share, like, a story that you... A good one from that time or something, you know,
well,
that
I can share
stands out?
One from when I was stationed in Germany.
Okay.
Stick around. We'll be right back with a continuation of the story. Welcome back to Community Stories on WFHR. We're glad you're here for the rest of the story.
So can you share like a story that you, a good one from that time or something, you know,
I can share one from when I was stationed in Germany.
Okay.
And was doing my job copying Morse code. And the people in the communist side of Germany knew we were listening to them and they were listening to us. We knew that. So I'm sitting and I'm typing up with this guy ascending. And I was at a place called Herzl Base, H-E-R-Z-O. Herzogenaurach was the name of the city, but they called it Herzl Base.
Okay.
And in the message it said, Merry Christmas, Herzl Base. So we knew that they were listening, we were listening to them. And then when we were in Vietnam, we were in Da Nang at the time, and I was going to the Air Force Base Exchange, or BX, which is like a huge Walmart.
Okay.
Big.
Right.
And we're checking out, and like I said, all our stuff was top secret, so not a lot of people knew what we were doing. And this Vietnamese girl was at the checkout counter, and we didn't have any any patches on our shoulders like many military people do because of what we were in. We couldn't.
Right, advertise that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And she asked me, she says, what unit are you with? And I said, well, 328th Radio Research. She says, oh, you listen to Charlie. So it was... Whatever.
But the secret that's not secret.
Exactly. The only one that didn't know were the Americans, but I mean, just interesting.
So one question I have, because I have been reading more World War II novels, which have, I try to read the ones that are based on history, mm-hmm. but maybe are a little bit fabricated. Were there any, did you know any women radio operators when you were in the service?
Personally, no, I did not. I'm just trying to think back. We had some, it was not just radio operators. We had a whole cadre of people. We had Morse code intercept operators. We had voice intercept operators. We had traffic analysts. We had code breakers. We had radio teletype people that would send the messages on. Mm-hmm. We were kind of, our work product went through the NSA. So there were ladies.
Which is the National Security
Agency. Correct, National Security Agency, because they would take and say, okay, where was this movement here? Where was this movement there? And, you know, what were they talking about? Where was this stash of food? Where was this stash of weapons? And, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. So we were kind of in the NSA, so to say.
Mm-hmm. But so there were women involved in that.
Right, but not directly in our unit as such.
Gotcha.
But there were in the line somewhere, there was ladies, veterans.
Wonderful. I wanted to verify mm-hmm. that with the history buff here that I have. You've lived it, so that's
yeah.
That's interesting.
Oh, and one of the other things we also do is we go to Assumption at Lincoln High School once a year. We talk to like the junior class in history. Because here we are. What do you want to know?
Wow. And just let them ask you questions?
Yeah.
Have you had a favorite question from a student?
Had some interesting questions. You know, what did you do in your off time? And they always ask, were you injured? Mm. You know, because there's myself and there's a guy that was in the infantry and artillery. And then there was another guy that was in communications, but not the same as I was. And then another guy that was a mortar operator. So there's all different aspects, but questions are interesting.
Yeah. So what did you do in your off time?
Because of what we did, we were told we could only travel around in groups of two or three. Mm. You couldn't go alone because you would be a target. In our off time, there was five of us in one hooch or building, little building, we call them hooches. And we would work the second shift. We had 24 hours where we're monitoring all the communications we can. And we would come back and we would play cards. They didn't have an American TV over there. So we would listen to the radio. And Kronauer was not the person that we listened to, that I can recall, Adrian Kronauer. And then we would just socialize quite a bit. There was some adult beverages consumed.
Mm-hmm.
we became very close, the five of us. And
talk about your families, talk about home.
Families, right. Only one of us of the group was married at the time. Mm-hmm. Another one of the group got married while he was over there, you know, because I was the best man at his wedding in California.
Oh, wow.
And we would just talk about life in general and have a good time.
Yeah, try to not talk about work.
Well, when you're sitting there in a war zone, we couldn't talk about what we did at work because it was all classified at that time. Mm-hmm. And they always told us, if you talk about it, you're going to prison.
So we
didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is one of the code words was a spice, name of a spice.
Okay.
And we had Christmas at our, my wife and I got married after I came back from Vietnam, and we had a Christmas at our trailer out in Virginia. All the guys that came back were there. And one of the ladies asked for this spice as they were cooking. And everybody's looking at me like, can't you keep your mouth shut?
Oh, no.
But, you know, it's like the old Groucho Marx show. You know, the little duck will come down if you use the magic word. Well, no, it's good. She doesn't know what's going on.
It's a spice that you use in cooking, so. Right.
But that was one of the code words.
Oh, wow.
So you never knew.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes those inside jokes or mm-hmm. things like that, and it's... So far, everybody that I have talked to that has been a veteran has spoken about what a bond you create with your fellow veterans.
We're still staying in contact. One of our group has passed. Another one is starting to have dementia issues. Mm. But we do stay in touch. And what was interesting is one year, my wife and I had a military reunion and my class reunion. I was closer to people I lived with for 6 months to a year than I was when I went to high school with for 12, 13 years.
Wow.
You are tighter bond. You know, your high school friends are still friends.
Of course.
There's no doubt about that. But your military friends are a little bit deeper. Mm-hmm. You kind of look at each other, and at one of our reunions, it was so funny because we got out in 72, and our first reunion was in 99. And you picked up the conversation like it
never stopped.
Like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, and just the bonding it's there.
That's wonderful. Well, let's take a short break, Tom. And when we come back, let's talk about what you're doing now after all of these experiences you had in Vietnam. We'll be back in just a moment.
No problem.
That moment will extend to next week when we'll pick up the rest of Tom Heiser's story. I'm Melissa Kay. Thank you for joining me today. We'll be back next Tuesday with more Community Stories.